It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go. We're off and running for this 18th day of October 2018. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you go if you'd like to jump in and be part of the merry, wacky, zany, multimedia, real-time extravaganza that is The Horn chat room. If you pick yourself out a screen name and a password over there, well, you'll be immediately greeted by Anatole and me. And, of course, longtime, inveterate, indefatigable chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a spacing guild master, has folded space to become Man Cave. A lovely 82 degree afternoon in Northern California for some light space folding, I'm told. It's a lovely 71 degrees here inside the fabulous Horn Studios at the magnificent Kincaid Mansion on the incomparable Kincaid Estate here in almost level West by Cold Trump Genius, Dan. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It's Thorn in the Side Thursday. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So let's do those things that we do that begin the program every evening. We have thanks to send out. Thanks to our subscribers. Thank you very, very kindly to Charlene in Rhode Island. Thanks very much indeed to Grace up in New York. Thank you, Grace. And thank you to Jeff in Oregon. Thank you to the three of you. Thank you to for being partial sponsors of the program and contributing toward keeping, taking care of about a fourth of what we try to raise here at The Horn in any given month. Thanks very much indeed. Thanks as well to Stephen, another subscriber. Thank you very kindly, Stephen. That is much appreciated. And thanks earlier in the day to Darius in Oregon. Thank you, Darius. Thank you very much. So the upshot of that is we closed the program last night with a $375 fundraising goal. With a $350 fundraising goal, and that takes it down to three, which you add to tonight, and we've got a $500 fundraising goal. Thanks very much for all the help getting as far as we've gotten. That means we've got $500 to raise tonight, $200 to raise tomorrow, a total of $700 to finish the week, which means that we knocked out Monday and half of Tuesday in fundraising, and so that's where we stand. And again, and this is not hyperbole. This is not this isn't like going to get called home or anything. If we don't finish fundraising for the week, there won't be a program come Monday. Plain and simple, because. Well, I can't stand out on the I can't stand out on the stoop and shout the program into the ether. So we need to knock that out. Hopefully a big chunk. Knock out tonight and knock out tomorrow, and then of course that means that we'll only have 3 days of fundraising left in the month of October, come Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of next week. So thanks to our subscribers, thanks to Darius for jumping in. We got $500 to raise this evening. Hey, that would be 50 new subscribers at $10 a piece, or 10 folks at $50 this evening. No new subscribers. Mr. Soros, you could just make it all ever so easy in one fell swoop. But that's where it stands. We got to raise $500 this evening. The link for helping keep the horn on the air is at headon.live. There's a PayPal link there. If you would like to become a new subscriber, and if we added one new subscriber every night between now and a year from now, we would be very close to having our entire fundraising goal met, and in a year from now, we could celebrate by me never having to do this again. Yeah, and do nothing but thank people. So there's a box at the PayPal link that you put a check mark in that says, you know, make this happen every month. And that's how folks set up subscriptions. Well, thank you very kindly. We are off and running. Thank you, Jeremy in Vermont. That means we have $495 to go this evening. And with any luck at all, that will be the start of a little fundalanche. And we'll go from there. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you very much indeed. So, Thorn in the Side Thursday, right? Yeah, right. This sounds like a lot of fun. Makes me wish we had the bandwidth to do a lot of video up in the man cave. I'm told that Grady the shop dog is lizard chasing in the man cave. Hopefully he won't catch it. That probably would not be a good thing, cleaning up after Grady catches a lizard. I remember what happened one time when a certain Labrador retriever I knew ate a groundhog. Ugh, not pretty. Well, so much for the dinner hour here in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone. Ew. Start out with a note from Ron and Raleigh. Subject line, please explain. While listening to Democracy Now! Today, they had a round table of Native Americans, and to a person, they were castigating Elizabeth Warren over the release of her DNA test. One of the complaints was that somehow this was a function of a colonial mindset that wants to cast Native Americans as immigrants. Another seemed to believe that by acknowledging her heritage, Senator Warren was doing a disservice to tribal peoples. One gentleman said that Ms. Warren and Donald Trump should both give $1 million to a Native American women's organization. Do you remember any complaints from the tribal leaders when Ben Nighthorse Campbell ran for the Senate as a Democrat and after he won, switched to the Republican Party? Both of the women running for lieutenant governor in Minnesota are Native Americans. The woman that is projected to win is a Republican. What the fuck? It's not like Senator Warren is trying to ride her Native heritage to some sort of advantage. She can't win for losing. Well, that last part is true. There was no way that this worked out to her advantage, whether she remained silent or whether she did something about it. The fact of the matter is, given the and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of history to be understood here. In the years in which the area that we now know as Alabama and Mississippi and most of Tennessee and the biggest part of Kentucky and Ohio as well. I'm accepting Michigan from this for a reason. But in particular, the southeast states that were at that time a frontier. I mean, there was a time when Alabama and Mississippi were the West. Okay? And before massive amounts of settlers began to make their way into that region, white people had been going in there by fits and starts. For instance, you want to talk of here? It's a fact. Sam Houston of Texas fame, of Texas War for Independence fame, that war which was fought for the rights of white people to continue to engage in chattel slavery over the objections of a Mexico which had outlawed it long before the United States even got around to thinking about it. Sam Houston was far more than 1/1024th or 1/862nd or whatever Native American. At the time of the Indian Removal Act, the people who in many ways led the objection to the said removal were, yes, Native Americans, but they were also of white extraction. I know a little bit about this because I grew up with this as part of the local history where I grew up. I'm thinking in particular of George Calbert, whose name in his partially native language was Tutumastube. And he was an admixture of Scottish and Chickasaw. He even recruited troops for Andrew Jackson and served as a captain underneath him in his slaughter of the Muscogee people. But there was a lot of that. Let's see, I'm trying to think of another name. Northeast Mississippi is peppered with names of Choctaw and Chickasaw leaders. Itawamba is a county in Mississippi named for a relative of George Calbert named Levi Calbert. And he never saw Oklahoma, but did see the Indian removal, the Trail of Tears, take place. And he identified as Native. He grew up among Native peoples, the Chickasaw. Let's see. Another Chickasaw leader named Tishomingo, which translates as second in command. And he was much beloved of the white folks for a time there. He, unlike Itawamba, was full-blooded Chickasaw. But whether it be the Chickasaw, the Choctaw, the Cherokee, the Shawnee, the Delaware, white folks didn't have much of a problem breeding, but making children. Human beings, wherever you get them together, will sooner or later have sex with each other. And the white folks could be pretty pushy about it. But the larger issue is that Elizabeth Warren was behind the eight ball in this particular instance. She has a family history of there being, and even this is troublesome, because it's her family history is of there being some Indian blood in her, as if somehow you can put blood under a microscope and you can see which ones, which corpuscles are indigenous and which corpuscles are white European. That's bullshit. And of course, it's a concept that was initially invented by the white colonialists, because they use it for discriminatory purposes. Long before the English were really got a good foothold going, the Spanish were engaging in questions of blood, quatroons, octoroons, doubloons. No. Because the earliest manifestations of the one drop rule originated with the Spanish in Nueva España, Mexico, in which to have one drop of indigenous blood was enough to corrupt the entire bloodstream of a person of good Catalonian or Andalusian stock. Yeah, we have the Spanish to thank for that. Turned out the English and the Americans after them were much better at straight-up genocide than the Spanish were. The Spanish slaughtered the bejesus out of native peoples, but, frankly, there were just too many for them. Even them with their steel and their guns and their germs to be able to finish the job. On the other hand, by the time the white colonialists from England are marching across the heartland of what we now call the United States, they were encountering a vast and in many instances empty place, and the people that they did meet were remnant peoples who had not managed to die of disease in the previous generations. We really have no idea how many millions of indigenous people in this hemisphere died at the hands of white people without ever having so much as set eyes upon one, because diseases back then traveled faster than people did. For all we know, in the southeastern United States, diseases began felling tribal peoples, indigenous peoples, with the arrival of DeSoto and his disease vectoring through Florida, Georgia, part of North Carolina, Alabama, Tennessee, Mississippi. Yeah. And so I don't know what the strategy was for Senator Warren to do what she did when she did. I don't think that there were any maggots out there on the fence, maggots who said, "Well, you know, I was thinking about voting for that fill in the blank Joe Manchin. I was a thinking about voting for that Beto O'Rourke. I was a thinking about voting for that there Phil Bredesen, who then said, "Oh, well, but, yeah, Elizabeth Warren, I guess I'm going to vote for somebody who hates indigenous people." It runs contrary to logic. But I don't make much noise about it because I can't, A, prove it, and B, it doesn't change anything about me. Like most, well, dare I say most? Yeah, probably most. Many Appalachian people who've been here for a lot of generations, we have legends that somewhere in our past there is, and it's usually an indigenous woman, a great-grandmother of some sort, who was full-blooded fill-in-the-blank Shawnee, Cherokee, Chickasaw, Choctaw. And in many instances, it can be proven. But these are people who grew up in white communities. Especially in Appalachia, because with the enforcement of the Indian Removal Act, and remember what a blot on our history that was, the Supreme Court of the United States actually got that right. And they struck down Jackson's Indian Removal Act, said it was unconstitutional. And Andrew Jackson said, "Justice Marshall has made his ruling. Now let him enforce it." And that's why many Native peoples in this country to this day will not use a $20 bill, because they will not besmirch themselves with the image of Andrew Jackson. It's also why Andrew Jackson features so prominently in the White House, in the Oval Office, as decorated by Julius Geezer. Because making Navajo code talkers stand underneath a portrait of a man who wanted to, who thought that there could be nothing better than slaughtering every last Native person on this continent, is, you know, it's a profound reminder of where he stands. And of course, this would be a good time to mention hashtag Donald Trump is a white supremacist. We discussed this once upon a time on one of my trips up into the Northwoods. And I told the people that I was there talking with, and I said, you know, I can't identify because I have none of the heritage and none of the understanding that comes with such identification. On the other hand, for the Cherokee Nation to get all red-assed, and I don't mean that in a term in any sort of demographic term. I mean that in terms of pissed off about what. For them to get bent out of shape, no, because there are people who have been demonstrable Native ancestry who have not been able to gain access to, in that case, the Cherokee Nation, for years. When, in point of fact, some of the earliest heritage of the interplay. History of the interplay between Native peoples and white peoples is that where white peoples were racist and were bigots, early on, people with somewhat open minds found out that the Natives weren't. The tribes opened their arms to runaway slaves and even to white people who wanted nothing to do with their colonialist existence. I mean, the comparison, say, between the Shawnee people and the people who settled in the drainage of the New River in Appalachia is stunning. The Shawnee people bathed every day. The Shawnee people had reasonably long lifespans. The Shawnee people had a division of labor and a division of decision-making that was egalitarian and gave a significant amount of the decisional power to the women in the band. Whereas women in colonial America had no rights, no power, and were, in fact, in a large sense, property. And so you had, there's a history in this region of white folks being accepted into native groups, or as the white settlers, well, they were kidnapped by the Indians. The only thing was, the Indians didn't kill them, and in many instances, the white folks didn't want to go back because it was a far better life than the colonial life was. But it's a complicated issue, and yet at the same time, it's uncomplicated, because there was no right way for Elizabeth Warren to have done this, and Donald Trump was going to continue calling her Pocahontas regardless. And I think that's sort of getting lost in the mix right now. Ron, up in the soon-to-be frozen north, says, I like Senator Warren. She's feisty, smart, and articulate. However, her sense of timing sucks. She sucked up media bandwidth for at least 2 days, didn't do anything to help the hoped-for blue wave, and gave dipstick Donnie and his minions something to gleefully point at while sneering. The thing is, she proved herself to be what she had said she was. Within five or six generations, there's some indigenous DNA in her lineage. But now, apparently, where once upon a time, and maybe because they learned the hard way, where once upon a time indigenous groups said, come one, come all, for instance, the Seminoles of Florida eagerly welcomed runaway slaves. And I mentioned the Shawnee, and of course the Chickasaw, the Cherokee even. Now apparently they get indignant at this issue. But the question is, what other thing should she have done? Continued, because again, they weren't going to leave it alone, these white wingers. And let's do remember that Donald Trump is a white supremacist, and Donald Trump despises native peoples because they have from time to time gotten in his way. Someone whose opinion I value, because I've worked with him for a long time in the mountaintop removal struggle, said earlier, and he is, he has bona fide native heritage. He simply said, okay, Senator Warren, honor and respect to your native ancestors. What are your plans to honor them and seek justice for our people? Which I think gets right down to the heart of it. It's one thing to say, I got some Indian blood in me, but I can't prove it. And my buddy always gets a laugh out of whatever group he's talking to, because he'll introduce himself and say, I got some white in me, but I can't prove it. And thereby turning the whole issue on its head. He went on to say, when folks ask my native blood quantum, I always respond, I'm a quart low. And added, I myself have German-Jewish lineage, which probably accounts for why I put sauerkraut on my kosher fry bread. What's the line from that Bill Murray movie? We're mutts. Yeah. But in this case, you can't, you've got to be a little more careful because you can't, white people who do have indigenous relations deep in their family tree, it might make you feel better about yourself. As I've remarked in the past, the vast majority, if I ever do get the $100 laying around to find out, I'm going to find out that I'm almost entirely English, a little bit German, and a bit Scots, and that's what my heritage is. It is not who I am. Who I am in 2018 is a middle-aged pink guy from Appalachia. If I'm anything on a regional basis, it's Appalachian. I am American because I was born in the United States of America. Regionally, I'm Appalachian. I would be absolutely tickled if I could find out that great grannies on a couple of sides of my lineage were indigenous people, but it would also engender a response that to wonder why she had to hide her heritage behind a wall of whiteness in order to be safe. And I certainly wouldn't send off for my 8x10 color glossy certificate suitable for framing. And I wouldn't be running around saying, hi. No. What I can do is what I've done all along, and that is to try to manifest a great degree of respect for the people, the first peoples who were here, and the brilliance of the cultures that they developed, and a sense of shame for the destruction of that culture, and a desire that this country do a far better job of making amends. And so, you know, as Ron and Raleigh points out, one of the people on the panel said that she and Trump should both give $1 million to a Native American women's organization. Well, that's exactly what Elizabeth Warren said she was going to do. The whole reason she finally responded was to get sufficient information to respond to a promise, a white man's promise from Donald Trump to give $1 million to a charity of her choosing if she could prove that she had Native ancestry, because his position is that she had absolutely none and that she is somehow trafficked upon it and advanced her career by it, when in fact, at the same time that the DNA information was released, information was also released by various and sundry agencies and institutions saying that she had never been promoted through any program that relied upon her any sort of indigenous heritage. But again, that has not slowed down the white wingers, who are still shrieking about how she only got where she is by abusing her heritage. These self-same white wingers also don't seem to understand very much the way that backward-looking through one's ancestry generates some pretty interesting numbers of an exponential variety. You've got two parents. That means you got four grandparents. that means you've got each grandparent had two parents. So you've got eight sets of great-grandparents, 16 great-great, and it mounts up pretty quickly after that. It's one of those things that makes tracking down genealogy so damned interesting. You never know who you're going to run across. But in the midst of all of this, you can always find some pretty nasty white wing racism. Yeah. And for that, we go to South Carolina and Lindsey Bell Graham, who showed up a couple of mornings ago on Fox News TV Radio Rwanda to do the bidding of his master. Let's start at the front end. On the front end, they were talking about immigration.
During the lame duck session. Right. Is there truth to that? Will they be able to get all the funding?
Yeah, I hope so. Well, the House is $1.5 billion for the wall. I mean, excuse me, $5 billion. The Senate has $1.5 billion. We'll close the gap. DACA, remember that?
$1.5 billion?
90,000 kids brought here on the average age of six. No place else to go. Trump's going to win in court. He can repeal DACA. The day he wins in court, what do we do with these young people? So I'd like to do a deal. Full wall funding for DACA.
Wow, that would be interesting, but then they're going to get into chain migration.
Nope, keep it simple.
Right, well, we'll see what that will goes.
One for one.
That would be a good thing, knowing.
Now, Steve Ducey is right. Madcap band of psychotics in the Feedum caucus over in the House of Representatives will try to tie it to so-called chain migration. You know, that policy of the United States that says that immigrants here don't have to live here all by themselves, but instead can bring over some immediate family members. You know, just like melanoma did.
The Congress is going to be a different makeup to shortly.
More Republicans.
When you see these Guatemalans heading here, it's even bigger than the last caravan. What are your thoughts about what we should be, what right. This does for the immigration debate and what is going to do with our border shortly?
Well, it makes the immigration debate more on Trump's terms. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no right to come to America. You know, we can have rules about who comes. And we're
It's just like Fat Dead Tony Scalia said, there's no right in the Constitution of the United States to not be executed for a crime you didn't commit. Jesus, I love the way these freaks' minds, what passes for minds, pass for working. Yeah, we may get into the immigration issue a little bit more. But deep in the conversation, Lindsey, he found his inner South Carolinian, his inner racist.
Fox, after all the president has done, this guy's got to go. Saudi Arabia, if you're listening, there are a lot of good people you can choose, but MBS has tainted your country and tainted himself.
Yeah, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, has got to go, says Lindsey from underneath the fainting couch. This will not play well with the people like darling Jared and adorable Ivanka and Daddy Donnie, who are reliant upon the Saudis for a whole lot of money. And he can say that till hell freezes over, but the other thing is the Saudis don't choose their leadership. Nobody went and voted for Mohammed bin Salman. It is a hereditary, autocratic, dictatorial monarchy, just so we're all on the same page here. But that wasn't what I was getting at.
Who to replace him?
That's up to them. It's not my job.
But there's another crown prince there.
There are a bunch of them.
There are hundreds.
Yeah.
It seems
it's your job, not mine, to pick
exactly.
You
So before you go,
on that cheery note,
One of the top stories in the world right now, Elizabeth Warren.
Yes.
DNA test. She could be anywhere from 164th to 1,000th Native American. You have a challenge.
I'm going to take a DNA test. All of you have. I've been told that my grandmother was part Cherokee and Indian. It may all be just talk, but you're going to find out in a couple of weeks because I'm going to take this test.
You are going to take it.
I'm taking it, and the results are going to be revealed here. This is my Trump moment. This is reality TV. I'm dying to know.
We wish you would.
Dying, you know, I didn't really think much about it, but she's less than 0.1%. I think I can beat her. I think I can beat her.
Right. And
I think I can beat her. I can. My goodness, you're getting rather catty in your old age, Lindsay. It's not a competition. She was merely trying to dismiss a racist smear that Donald Trump had been leveling and getting his maggots to level, because that's how fascism works, by referring to her by name as an early woman we know from colonial history who was taken from her home on this continent in a pretty lovely part of the country and dragged to England, where she became an alcoholic from the misery of being there and being surrounded by people utterly unlike her, and eventually succumbed to a loathsome white disease. We memorialize that in the Capitol Rotunda of the United States with a great big humongous portrait called The Baptism of Pocahontas. The background to all of this is that we really do need a reckoning. And it would largely be a reckoning led by indigenous people of just how awful and just how shitty and how miserable and how murderous the colonization and expropriation of this land was. We need to have that conversation, but the maggots dismiss it out of hand. Now, I don't know if there is any indigenous DNA in my ancestry, but I do know this much. I got DNA in my ancestry of some original land thieves. I know his name. I know where he stole his land. I know the stories. I know that he felt safe enough in this region that he walked the entire length of a river. And again, I'd love to know what the people who actually lived here called it. It's called the Meadow River. And he cut notches in trees all along the way. And he declared that because he had notched those trees, that land now belonged to him, and he spent the rest of his life giving it away to his children and his grandchildren. Hundreds of thousands of acres. All the way from what is Greenbrier County, West Virginia, along the Meadow River to the Gauley River and everything encompassed thereby, including the land that I'm squatting on at this moment. In Appalachia, which at the time it was dickered away to white people, was described as a dark and bloody ground and has proved to be such ever since. But it's all just a big ha-ha to Lindsey Graham. Because, you see, it's a joke to him. He's dying to know. But it's a joke because he is so thoroughly clothed in white privilege. See how it works? Lee in New York actually wrote an article about science and ancestry. Lee says we should know that our DNA is a small part of our past, saying we should understand what we learn from DNA tests and what we do not. A DNA test can tell a man about some of his father's 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 DNA. The Y chromosome passes on from father to son unaltered. Similarly, a woman's mitochondrial DNA is from her mother's 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 mother. The issue is the rest. Most people have 23 chromosome pairs. Half of a person's DNA comes from the mother, the other half from the father. Gregor Mendel studied the mechanism of inheritance. He learned about dominant and recessive traits. Without knowing structure that stored traits, he understood mechanism that sends traits from generation to generation. Just a couple of generations out, it's going to become very difficult to spot who your ancestors were. Now, I, for instance, and this made learning about Gregor Mendel a little bit easier for me. Both of my parents had brown eyes, but their parents, one parent had blue eyes and the other parent had brown. And so, even though both of my parents were brown-eyed, lo and behold, here I am with blue. Lee says DNA tests don't show your ancestry. They only show part of your ancestry. People think of their ancestry as a lineage on a family tree going back many generations. It's accurate as far as it goes, but a person's DNA will not have all that data. We are not a stew of ancestry. We are a collection of discrete values. Every gene you have came from an ancestor. Some genes from your ancestors did not get to you. And posits an experiment. Get 8 boxes of 8 different crayon colors. Make a list of the colors. Sort the crayons by color. Each color represents a great-grandparent's DNA. Put 2 colors, 16 crayons, in a bag and blindly pick 8. Keep that 8 as a group. Repeat 3 more times. There are 4 groups of 8. Put 2 groups, 16 crayons, in a bag and blindly pick 8. Keep that 8 as a group. Repeat with the remaining 16 crayons. There should be 16 crayons in total. Put them in a bag and blindly pick 8. Look at the colors. If you do not have 8 different colors, that color is missing. It was not inherited. Also, some of each color did not get to the final set. That is the genetics of inheritance. Your DNA test can only ever show some of where you came from. For all intents and purposes, DNA testing is a parlor trick. And it's a corporate parlor trick to get you to put your DNA into a database. I recently read an article that says that almost anybody in the country could be identified by the DNA that's already on file, simply with a few basic details, even if you haven't contributed your DNA at this point. Oh, insurance companies love that. And make no mistake, even though you don't get all of someone's genes from 5 generations ago, somewhere out there, there's a life insurance company or a health insurance company saying, yeah, but you know, she might have. So that's why we're going to charge them 10 times as much if they have a heart attack. In case they have a heart attack. Because capitalism. Because dice rolling. As Ron points out, Ms. Lindsey said that he was going to take a DNA test because he could beat the amount of DNA that Senator Warren has, and he was going to ask for $1 million in a casino. Yeah, I'd stop before we got there.
If you do beat her, will you ask for $1 million from the president, too?
No, I want a casino and $1 million.
Ho, ho, ho. And if it turns out you've got some African-American blood, Lindsey, you're going to ask for 40 acres and a mule? You dick. There is no end to white privilege. Ron notes, we have an entire tribe here in North Carolina
that the federal government won't recognize. The Lumbee have been trying for years to be recognized by the feds. Isn't it amazing that a group of Native Americans has to ask white men to recognize who they are? Oh, yeah, and one band that was recognized fairly recently down in Alabama, they are a subgroup of the Muscogee, which white folks called Creek. And they're called the Porch, P-O-A-R-C-H. And during the time that they were seeking federal recognition, which again, as Ron notes, is offensive as hell. The number of good Christian white Alabamians who hollered about they're just light-skinned, that word. I heard it more than I care to think about. Scott out in San Diego says, it all comes down to this. Sooner or later, many of us ultimately discover that we are descended from a long line somebody foolishly listened to in the back of a Buick with steamed up windows. Yeah, or we find out that we're descended from a long line of assholes and ignorant people. As I've pointed out, the Scottish side of me, I am not Scottish. I am partially of that heritage or that descent, but I ain't Scots. Even my accent's really stupid. I found out that the people who came over here and eventually winds up with me and some cousins, they lost their literacy in about a generation. They went from highly literate, thinking people to scrabbling in the dirt hillbillies in under 100 years. Ron in the far frozen north says, please point out that the Ron you're quoting isn't the poor shivering brother up north. He's far more informed and articulate down in North Carolina. I was trying to keep him straight, but yeah, I can see where that could be confusing. But Ron in the far soon to be frozen north says, but if you could afford to buy the whiskey, would you be Scott? No, I would be sot. Ah. Mm-hmm. Darlene in Connecticut, subject line, Lindsey Graham cracker. It's not a joke either. He's making a mockery of having Native American blood in your veins. Well, yeah, he is. And I guess he... What is it? First they laugh at you? First they fight you? No, first they laugh at you. Then they fight you. Then you win. And of course, more to the point, I remain convinced that the indigenous peoples of this hemisphere may be the only hope that humanity has. By the way, 6 minutes before the hour, and we have 11 years and 355 days to figure out a way out of the trick box, the hydrocarbon trick box that we're in. 11 years and 355 days. Once again, checking the morning news, as is my wont. Not a goddamn mention of the fact. But lots of talk about fleeting, ephemeral horse race numbers for various elections. Robert in Australia says, Native Americans need a more restrictive immigration policy. You know, that's said somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but it's the absolute truth, because in almost every area where white folks landed, there were two groups that were at each other's throats. And one of them inevitably would decide that, hey, let's be nice to the pale people. They seem to have some shit that could come in handy for us to put our enemies under our boots. Because North America was not, you know, there's the danger of the so-called noble savage and the infantilization of Native peoples. And that's equally racist. We're talking about human beings with full agency. And in every instance, it worked out. And I think I talked about this a week or two ago. In every instance, it worked out to the overall detriment of every indigenous group in the region. It happened in New England with the religious maniacs who landed there. It happened in Virginia with the the corporate maniacs who landed there. And the best example of all is what happened in the Valley of Mexico when the sworn enemies of the Triple Alliance said, hey, we got 40,000 guys sitting around not doing anything. Sure, we'll help you topple the we'll help you topple that empire that we despise. And in each instance, there was somebody there, if you dig up the history, who were saying, you know, we really need to stand together on this. But had it not been Columbus, it would have been someone else, because the technology existed to cross oceans. And whoever else came along would have been equally vicious and equally avaricious. And what we're talking about is largely a matter of human nature. David in South Carolina, subject line, Lindsay Loonhead. Lindsay Loonhead strikes again. Ho, 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 I think I got more blood than her. Ho, ho, ho. Yeah, as Darlene points out, it's a joke to him. Hey, Lindsay, go out and live at Pine Ridge for a couple of years and tell me how fucking funny it is. Go out and live on any of the various reservations in the American Southwest and tell me what a laugh riot those folks are. Todd in South Carolina stands, says, Native American ancestors. It's interesting how some people are turning proof of Native American ancestry into a sport, especially since they wouldn't give 2 cents to a real Native. It could be that certain people deep down want to identify as Native to truly feel American. Nice article by Lee. Ron and Raleigh really painted the square on the Lumbee issue. Take care. Signed, Barbecue Todd. Oh, dear, I had no idea. Asa with a programming note for us. Hey, by the way, Bob's Filthy Morning Habits are going to be talking to Stephen Colbert tonight. Anyone interested should tune into CBS at 11:35 local time. I'll try to catch the rerun on that. I can't get the local CBS affiliate. Too far by antenna and not allowed via DirecTV Now. Oh, thanks. Thanks going out. Thank you very kindly indeed. Goes out to our buddy Dave from Talibandiana. Says, here's $10 to keep you rolling. Happy birthday, Horn Community Congregation. Because that's true. I haven't been beaten on that a whole lot. But yes, on the 24th, it will be our 15th anniversary here. 15 years of this program. Every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday evening, 6 to 9 p.m. for 15 years. And the ultimate irony, of course, is that we won't have a 15th anniversary program if we don't raise $500 this evening and $200 tomorrow. So there's that. But it's we're down to not 500 this evening. but rather $485. $485 to go this evening in fundraising, thanks to Dave from Talibandiana and Jeremy in Vermont. Let's see. And by the way, David in South Carolina points out, media attacked Warren worse for the DNA test than they attacked Donald Trump for the constant slurs against Native Americans. And that's the absolute truth. I got an example of it. That example comes from, of course, an arguably un-American member of the Republican Party. He bailed out a while back. This is disgusting. Jason Chaffetz of Utah, who looks like an Osmond that got left. Talk about a thin gene pool. He looks like an Osmond that got left on a doorstep somewhere in Utah. Maybe he was the extra Osmond. I don't know. He's now a Fox News contributor, having previously done everything he could to protect Donald Trump from being exposed as the foreign agent and enemy of America that he is. Well, he went on Twitter and posted a picture of himself standing next to a wooden Indian in tribal garb at Disney. He captioned the photo on Twitter, "At Disneyland today with Senator Elizabeth Warren." This is going to count, call for,
You dick!
Mm-hmm. It's, of course, going to, it's not like it's going to cost him his job at Fox. The maggots love this stuff. And here's the question for anybody who really wants to go all in on taking pot shots at Elizabeth Warren over this. What was she supposed to do? What? Anything. Somebody tell me. She says something, she gets torn apart by Trump, the maggots, and the media for it. The media did a terrible job of covering it. She didn't say that she was a member of the Cherokee Nation. She didn't say that she had that she was deserving of any particular recognition, or that she was partaking of any particular quota, and the evidence has repeatedly shown that she did not. And yet, there's actually a larger lesson that Democrats need to learn from this. And that is, with the for-profit media and with the maggot base, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't if you respond to one of Trump's slurs. The only way to respond to one of Trump's slurs is to slur him right back. For instance, maybe Senator Warren should have said, well, whatever it is that's in my DNA, I don't have a pimp and a coward. And somebody from a gene pool that was so shallow, you couldn't drown a piss ant in it. And then go fully on the attack and talk about what a pile of human shit Donald Trump is, Donald Trump's daddy, Donald Trump's mama, Donald Trump's granddaddy, great granddaddy. Trash them all. And that's really, but you've got to have a talent for that kind of thing. Hillary didn't. Neither did Bernie. Joe Biden doesn't seem to. I don't know who does. But this is a gin we're not going to get back in the bottle. This has been spilled out into our body politic, and it's not likely to get any better anytime soon because it's been turned into an industry. Jeremy with a note. Subject line, Native people. More importantly, did anyone else hear the Sioux representatives on Monday on Rachel Maddow, who closed his piece with her by saying, our people forgive the representatives of this state and country, speaking about the attempt to steal their votes. Because General Custer already died for them, and good on Rachel for saying to the guests, thanks for being with us tonight. Yeah, I did hear that. And God only knows how many votes are going to be stolen in North Dakota, and God only knows what impact that's going to have, because it may well cost nominal Democrat Heidi Heitkamp her seat. That's a story. Yes. Bill in Allentown says, didn't Donnie start the bet for Senator Warren to take the DNA test? Now he's crowing about it because he lost. He's a fucking liar. The truth ain't in him. He's a pile of human waste. He's un-American. He would sell anybody except Ivanka, and maybe Ivanka, to the highest Saudi or Russian bidder. And ultimately has sold his own country. Then again, Trumps have never been known for being particularly loyal to their country. No Trump has ever shed a drop of blood or even served in the military of the United States. Granted, Pappy Trump did serve in the Klan. And remember, Grandpappy Trump was a pimp who got thrown out, literally deported from Germany for his refusal to serve in the German military. And I don't mean the Third Reich. The German military, as best as I can figure time-wise, of Bismarck. Brother Deacon Asa says, we need someone like Anthony Weiner to stand up and punch back at Trump. The existing crop of Democrats are too soft in the middle. True enough. Hey, thanks very kindly to Catherine. Catherine just took us down to $460 to go. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you so very much. Ralph's has put a $10 challenge on the table. If somebody will meet $10, I'll match it, and then I'll add 10 more. So that would take us down to 450. Thank you, Ralphs. Thank you very, very, very kindly indeed. Steve in New York says, here we go again. I'm so damned confused. How can we call Trump a pile of human waste? Doesn't that imply that he was at least one time human? I still, no, I'm a pile of human. I don't think that will stand up to logical scrutiny, Steve. Human waste is not human any more than chicken shit is chicken. Then again, he's also a chicken shit. Remember those bone spurs? Yeah. I still maintain, says Steve, that the closest thing he is to living is a lichen or fungus, or more likely a fungal spore. Subject line toe-to-toe, Ron in Raleigh says, the only person that could have gone up against Dolt 45 was Al Franken, and he's gone thanks to our snowflake Democrats. Thinking about that the other day. Now, remember who replaced Al Franken on the Judiciary Committee? Darlene in Connecticut says, sounds like the Republican radical right white wing are already rolling out the anti-Hillary Clinton playbook against Elizabeth Warren. Worked well in the past, so why not continue using it? Wonder how long they'll figure out a way to work lock her up meme against Elizabeth Warren. You know they're already digging. This is what any serious woman candidate for president will have to contend with going forward. Well, any serious woman Democratic candidate. Different story if it's a Republican woman who will just be a cloying, obsequious pinup for the Republican white male power establishment of the GOP. Well, if you were going to put it that way, Darlene, why didn't you just include a picture of Marsha Goodness Blackburn, because that's exactly what she is. Okay, with a $10 challenge on the table and trying to get down to 450 and trying to get the bills paid so that we're going to have a 15th anniversary of the horn next week. That's all out there. Let's run over to the phones. It's about 13 minutes past the hour. Haven't heard from Ron in the far frozen north for rather a long time. Hey, Ron, how are you?
Hi, Bob.
Been on the road or in the air some?
Oh, yeah, whole bunch. But I'm back on Earth for a little while.
Glad to know you didn't get murdered in any consulates or anything. I think maybe your mom, God rest her soul, back when she was worried about you going over there, might not have been so out of the ballpark after all.
Yeah, but it was the Saudis.
Yes.
If you remember back over the last two or three years, I've expressed some strong opinions about our partners in peace.
Hang on a minute. Let me help out there. You mean partners in peace?
Yeah.
Hey, you got the reverb too.
Yeah, well, I just thought I'd give a quick call. Once again, as always, I have nothing particular to say. I just wanted to let you know that the entire country did not descend into a WKRP moment with Les Nessman reporting the death of a turkey upon...
As God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly.
That has to be one of the best moments on TV ever. But we're into our second day of legalized marijuana, and the country's still together.
Well, I'm told you can see the cloud from space.
According to the news reports, the demand seemed to outstrip supply.
I'll be dipped. I mean, is there gonna be a problem meeting demand up there? I mean, you know, the limited growing seasons and all that.
Oh, no, they're building million square foot greenhouses up here. They're popping up all over the place. We're looking at it to become a major export product at some point. But
you mean when other countries stop losing their minds? Ron? Oh, Ron.
Okay.
There you are. You
Asian just... Fred. Sorry.
That's okay. No, I saw I saw one news story that said on a site called Shopify, on the day that that Far Canada legalized cannabis, that on Shopify there were about 100 pot orders per minute. And Shopify is, of course, the e-commerce engine that Canadian online cannabis stores use.
Yeah.
They're based in Ottawa. And, yeah, 100 orders a minute.
Yeah, I know them well. Even though a couple of the players in Shopify, they're doing okay. But the Ontario store, I've gone in and sniffed around their website, and it's remarkably civilized. They've got about 120 different products.
Sniffed around their website. I caught what you did there. Yeah.
They've got 120 products, ranges from bud to pre-rolled to oils. Every one of them is listed by THC, average THC content, and priced to compete with the street. So, and it gets delivered.
And do they give you strain and whether it's hybrid or mostly indica or mostly sativa or all that stuff?
All that stuff.
Fascinating.
And it gets delivered by Canada Post in an unmarked box within about, on average in Ontario, within 2 days of order. They take Visa, MasterCard, PayPal.
But they do not ship to the United States.
No, Sister Carol's already lamented several times about that.
Well, you know, Sister Carol's only got a fairly brief drive across Kansas to get to get to Colorado.
Yeah, true. I think she was more lamenting the lack of civilization as.
Well, yeah, that's general.
Yeah. And the other thing that happened the day it was announced is that the Solicitor General, or the Minister of Justice for Canada, said that they're going to be introducing legislation to remove the criminal convictions of all the people that have things on their record that are simple possession.
That seems kind of easy and self-evident, but nothing ever really is. But somehow that's you almost have to, don't you?
Well, governments don't have to do anything.
Well, I get that. Yeah.
Yeah, but I had one person on the Hill explain it to me. He says, "Well, Trump's going to be an asshole for as long as he's there. All we can do is sort of try to lead by example and show people what an alternative universe actually looks like." So, you know, between healthcare, legalized marijuana, an effective military that doesn't, try to project their power, you know, it's offset by a climate that sucks, but, you know, we're just trying to be a decent country, sort of Scandahoovia in North America.
You know, I had a note from Lauren, our correspondent and Canadian representative to Horn Nutraceuticals, or our Albertan representative to Horn Nutraceuticals, and she said she would be happy to begin sending me ice as soon as I would like, because they've been getting it there for a while, you having mentioned crummy climate and all.
Yeah, I saw wet snow coming down yesterday. And heavy frost this morning.
But truth be told, we got a snow warning here for Saturday, Sunday.
Well, snowshoes already had measurable amounts of snow.
I know. I'm not happy.
We're all doomed, Bob.
Well,
eventually.
You know, the best guess would be maybe to ask Reverend Craig or Reverend Williams for some intercessory prayer, but
let me check with him here. I'll be back in a second.
Okay. So, speaking of reviews along those lines, are you still besotted with the Old Weller Antique 107?
Absolutely. If you can get your hands on it, it's a great value. It's gone up here.
I asked the folks over at our local store if they had any notion that they'd be getting it in, and they said maybe for Christmas. Of course, the thing is, we're getting pretty close to for Christmas.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even Halloween yet, and I was walking through the big box retailer, and I was with Margie. And I just looked up and I stopped in my tracks and I said, no, God damn it, no. Because I was standing before a display of all manner of artificial Christmas trees.
Yep.
And I had to dig extra hard to find a bag of the of my preferred charcoal.
And what charcoal do you like, Kingsford?
Bite your hillbilly tongue. I do not care to have any actual coal in my charcoal, and Kingsford has it.
Yeah.
No, I found a brand at that store, sadly, called B&B.
I've seen it, yeah.
And you can get it either as all hickory charcoal or hickory blend. I, of course, being a purist, go for the all hickory. Oh, and by the way, it's going to be a little bit of a challenge because I could not get the dried chili pepper pods that I need for it. But the Bridge Day pot of chili is underway. A pound of cranberry beans and a pound of Mayakobas, and the brisket is simmering along with the beans, having been previously smoked, and it's probably going to be really, really good. The beans are cooking in beef broth, by the way.
Well, speaking of, barbecue, every Thanksgiving, Sue and I go down to middle of Vermont to an area called Sugar Bush. We get access to a 3-bedroom condo with a fireplace and full TV package and Wi-Fi for $100 a week, which is outrageous.
That's criminal.
It's damn near enjoyable, but they've got a great barbecue in the back out on the patio. And unless it's pissing down snow, I'm going to take about 4 pounds of brisket with me this time and do a slow hickory smoke on the barbecue with an indirect heat. And smoke that sucker for about 6 or 7 hours and take down a big pot of Quebec maple bacon baked beans.
Ooh.
Yeah. And Sue's going to make up some biscuits. I'm going to take a...
I bet Sue does a mean biscuit.
Oh, I just had some tonight.
Catheads?
No, just basic buttermilk biscuits.
So not great big humongous, but yeah.
No.
Can you taste the real trick with buttermilk biscuits is this. Can you taste the buttermilk?
Yes.
See, there you go.
But see, I especially enjoy Sue's biscuits because they're the biscuits I always wanted to have when I was a kid. And somehow or other, my mom never figured out how to make them. And I got in deep kimchi once because it broke a window with one of her biscuits.
What? Wait, was your mom Lisa Douglas from Green Acres?
Oh, no. No. My mom was hampered by A, never having had a cooking lesson, and B, cooking on an old wood stove that I think we inherited from somebody. Temperature was fairly irregular.
I can imagine. And the, you know, biscuits are an art, Ron. Yeah. I'm not very good at them myself because no matter how hard I try, and I've been told by expert biscuit makers, I work the dough too hard and it comes out resembling, pie crust. You know, kind of crisp, a little crispier than you want.
Yeah. Well, I married an artist. And to demonstrate that fact, I'm just going to tell you my New Year's resolution.
Already working on it, huh?
Yeah, my resolution this year was to lose 10 pounds. And I've only got 15 pounds to go.
Oh, this is last January's. Took me a minute. Wait, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. A phenomenal cook. But light, fluffy buttermilk biscuits.
Well, you know, you remind me of something that you're reminding me of something that I had down at a wonderful, it's a chain, but it's not like, you know, McDonald's. There's four or five of them. They're slowly expanding. But the one I was at was on Magazine Street in New Orleans, and it's a breakfast place. They're only open until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And it's called the Ruby Slipper. And they did this open-faced buttermilk biscuit with egg however you want it.
Yeah.
Poached, fried, scrambled, whatever. Topped with hollandaise and pulled pork. And, man, to take one of those biscuits you're talking about and do that and put a little tender shredded brisket on it. Whew! Yeah. But go ahead.
I remember growing up, and I knew I was poor over in the hills of northern Greenbrier County because we'd have breakfast with, you know, farm eggs, unpasteurized milk, and tenderloin on salt bread brown toast.
Ooh, salt rising bread?
Yep. That's, I was poor, I tell you.
Yeah, well, that stuff stinks like grim death, but the salt rising bread does. But mercy, it's good.
Yeah. And I came to Canada, and one of the first folk stories I heard was about the kids in Newfoundland and the Maritimes trading their lobster sandwiches for bologna at school.
Yeah, because lobster was just junk food.
Yeah, they were poor. Yeah. Yeah.
Poor them. You know, I have figured out one thing though. It's a different thing to when you're trying to do brisket over, you know, like charcoal fire. It's a different affair than trying to do, say, ribs or even a pork butt. Because if you get the whole brisket like I do, you're going to have a thick end and it's going to taper down to a thin end.
Yep.
And that thin end will get done long before the thick end does. So I kind of had to come up with a workaround, and that is to smoke the whole thing for about 10 hours, and then put it in a big aluminum throwaway roasting pan with some water and some spices around it, and yeah. Cover that with aluminum foil, and then let it go for another, you know, 4 or 5 hours. Then it's tender and everything's delicious.
Put one of those small aluminum pans, and about 4 hours in, when I'm refreshing the hickory chips or apple chips or whatever I'm using, is to put in a small aluminum pan with covered with a few holes punched in it and fill the thing with beer and let it steam. Adds a different flavor.
No, that'd be nice.
Yeah. So it's all good, Bob. Some's just better than others.
Well, that's true, too. Hey, I've got a question back on the cannabis issue up in Canada. Ron and Raleigh, your counterpart, Ron. One more Ron, and there will be a fraternity of Ron. Says
just one time. But...
I understand that people in jail for cannabis offenses will be getting out of prison. How many folks will be getting out of the hoosegow? Is Canada allowing banks to accept cannabis money? So there's a couple of different questions there. How many people will be turned out of the prison system for pot offenses? But secondly, does Canada have the same problems that the United that states like Colorado ran into, and well, West Virginia, in terms of banks being able to deal with the monetary results?
Question one: the only number I've heard is somewhere just north of 700,000 as to whether people that are actively currently in the hoosegow will be released. I don't know. I would
wait. There aren't 700,000 Canadians in prison for pot offenses, are there?
No, there's 700,000 on record of having been convicted of possession offenses. And it will be expunged from their records. I would assume by that logic, if they're in now, even if it's for, 6 weeks or 2 months or whatever, they would also be released and it would be expunged.
Wow.
Question number two. I have heard of no problems here simply because medical marijuana has been available for several years, and it's all from licensed suppliers, and the government gets their cut. So it's best if the government allows the money to go into the bank. And that holds true for current legalized sales. Get charged the full federal and provincial sales taxes wherever applicable. The government gets their cut, plus whatever markup they get on the initial purchase before sale. So, the government's got an interest in letting people put their money in the bank.
Now, as for what's actually legal, you can possess up to how much at a time for owning and sharing?
30 grams, that's about the equivalent of 50 joints.
That's about an ounce, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can also grow your own, right?
To four per household.
Now, is that four plants, or is that, because you can start a bunch of seeds, but you're going to have to cull out the males so that you get the female flowering plants. So is that four plants grown to maturity, and is that per annum per household?
That's four plants at any given point in time, mature plants per household.
So you could have multiple growing seasons on an individual basis?
Oh, yeah. You can grow that stuff year-round if you got lights. And by the way, you cannot find grow lights. Every Home Depot and Lowe's for miles around have been sold out of anything to do with hydroponics.
Now, I've read something that if there's going to be an issue, perhaps an immigration issue or a border issue, a customs issue on the Great Northern Border, not insofar as people trying to bring weed in. I mean, that'll be, what it is. But more in terms of people... That U.S. Border enforcement people are going to be empowered to be sort of selective, but can ask things like, do you believe in legalized weed? And if you go, yes, they can refuse you entry into the United States.
I'll tell you what, I won't discount what you've said. What I've heard and what has been reported is that if you are an investor or owner in a company that grows or sells legalized marijuana, you can be turned back.
But the customs people can even ask, have you smoked marijuana?
Absolutely.
And that something as simple as saying yes to that in a country where it's legal can be used to keep you out of the United States.
Let's face it, Bob, U.S. border official, as Canadian border officials have the same power, they can ask you a question. Are you using acne medication? And if you say yes, They can turn you back. They can turn you back for any reason whatsoever, and they don't have to justify it. They can't take you into custody. They can't look through your stuff as a result. But they have far more power in terms of individual rights. Your constitution is suspended. If you're in the U.S., your constitution is effectively suspended when you're, if you're within 25 miles of the border. They can do a stop and search for any reason whatsoever for anyone.
Yeah, what about people flying into the United States? Because, I mean, that could be a real pain in the ass. Let's say you fly, Toronto to Atlanta. Let's make it complicated. I presume there are straight shots from Toronto to Atlanta, but you're at customs in Atlanta, and somebody from customs says, y'all smoke any marijuana in the last week? And, oh, yeah, it's legal. How do you manage to get back on the plane to Toronto?
Oh, you go into holding. And the next plane that they can find a seat for you, you leave on. But I would point out one small fact. If you're flying from Toronto to anywhere in the U.S., you go through pre-clearance U.S. customs in Canada. So when you land, you don't go through customs. Same out of Vancouver, same out of Ottawa, same out of Montreal.
So you just get sent home.
Yeah.
From the airport there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hate to say it, but I got a feeling because, you know, this is Trump-merica.
Yeah.
And I got a feeling this is going to be a problem.
I can't fault you on your logic. I've run into two or three, I don't want to refer to them as genetically deprived, but some of the border people I've run into, U.S. officials lately, have been a tad more antagonistic than they needed to be to, you know, an old, withered, gray-haired white guy.
Just some generic old gray-haired, withered. Yes.
The other thing, Agent Fred, turn off your phone. The other thing I do is my U.S. passport is pristine. It doesn't have a single visa stamp on it except for evidence of me entering from Canada to the U.S. When I come back into Canada from the U.S., I always use my Canadian passport, which is peppered with all kinds of visas from interesting places.
And funny writing.
I would never dare show that to a U.S. border person, ever.
Because they'd have a conniption.
Oh, they would. They would.
So I don't know if this is a question I should refrain from asking, but I'm going to anyway.
Well, it's hardly ever stopped you before, Bob.
That's true too. So, given the experience that you have, do you have any particular insights on what we're experiencing, or what? Well, on the current disgrace, horror, the Khashoggi matter, the Khashoggi murder.
Well, a lot of different veins I could mine there. If you look at the Saud family, there's roughly 4,000 princes across something like 100 or 110 descendants who have a legitimate claim on the crown. MBS at the moment is the first example of a direct lineage in terms of passing on power from the king. Usually it skips out sideways and picks somebody else and goes down.
Are you saying that he runs straight downhill from Ibn Saud?
Yes, sort of like a West Virginia genealogy thing. Looks like a straight stick. Yeah.
Now. No knees. No need to be shitty about it.
Well, I'm, you know, animal husbandry has a multiplicity of meanings, right? That's what I tell folks up here. In any event, back to the Saudis, this is a fairly overt and radical change within Saudi Arabia, and both from their internal view and from their perspective on the world. On the one hand, MBS, sounds like a rapper, is really doing a good job of emasculating the Wahhabi sect, the religious sect, that effectively have allowed the government to maintain power and control all these years. So on the one hand, that's a good thing. But the Saudis, particularly in the royal family and within the military, who have big representation from the Saudi royal family, have got to be looking at this and going, okay, we don't like the way this is rolling out. I wouldn't be surprised to see some kind of an upheaval over there within the next 6 months. And they may revert back to more of the doctrine, Wahhabi doctrine, you know, very strict control of the population. But generally speaking, by international diplomatic principles, they adhered to worldwide norms in terms of how they acted outside of their country. So it's going to be one of those things where both sides are going to, looking in left and right from outside, are going to get a chance to find something to bitch about. Because if they stay the way they are, the more open-minded people around the world are going to be railing against their governments to do something to impose stricture upon Saudi Arabia. If the right wing in Saudi prevails and they go back to more of a strict doctrinaire approach, then they're going to have people complaining to them again, things like women can't drive, can't vote, etc. But they would probably not be doing some of the outrageous shit they're doing right now. So it's going to be one of the, pick your devil. Neither one is going to be, the way I see it, neither outcome is going to be one that reflects the current norm. Something's going to change within 6 months. One man's vote, it's worth what you paid for it.
So, you know, there's often the concept of unintended consequences. One of the things that had been said, and I saw a clip of Thomas Friedman talking about it from a year or so ago. And of course, anytime he speaks, you can generally assume that whatever he's talking about, he's wrong. But he was cheerleading for MBS.
He looked like a breath of fresh air for about 3 weeks.
You mean until he started rounding up the other princelings?
Yeah, and getting $100 billion extorted from them, yeah.
And so if he should be removed, and one wonders how you go about doing that,
there is a ruling council.
Then what's the likelihood that the guy you get after is going to be even worse?
Fairly slim. There's some very well-educated and reasonable people. They're not in the majority, certainly, but they are in the ruling council, who would be very careful to pick someone that is not going to thoroughly piss off everybody in the West except Trump. I mean, they've got.
Well, okay, so you just mentioned the turd in the flower garden. What is his impact? He's into them, not they're into him.
Yeah, they've got a second mortgage on him. Putin's got the first mortgage, and Saudi's got the second.
So does it not really matter? Does his opinion just really not, come to anything?
Oh, you mean Trump's opinion?
Yeah.
If there's a regime change in Saudi Arabia, probably within 6 months to a year, Trump will be railing against them. But by then, he will have written off probably, you know, $50 to $100 million of his own money. And they will no longer have, you know, whole floors in Trump Towers in New York City. They will have sold it off at a loss. But take it, their major problem is their entire economy is driven by oil, the export of oil. You can't drink it. You can't eat it. And if people find some other place to buy it and indicate they're willing to pay more money for it, Saudi Arabia is bankrupt within 2 years. Even with all their money that's stored offshore, they're going downhill in a hurry. And they're not stupid. They're not necessarily likable, but they're not stupid.
So, you know, I confess my response is visceral because just about the time I began to be aware of my world, and I think that applies to about any human being at about age 10, along came the
OPEC
oil embargo of 1973. And I remember a lot of people back where I was growing up back then saying, I don't understand why we don't just bomb the shit out of them. And I'm a peaceful guy, you know. I'm a no-war kind of guy. Avoid war, you know. Well, it's straight out of Sun Tzu. War yeah. is the last choice, not the first. But you go from that to 3,000 Americans slaughtered again by Saudis.
17 of them were Saudis.
I thought, I thought 15 or 17, yeah. Well, 17, including the ones that didn't get on the planes, right?
Yes.
And I remember the stories about how the all the Saudis were quietly whisked out of the country when not another plane could get off the ground. And over the years, we've had the stories of slavery, Saudis keeping literal slaves in their homes in the United States.
And in the UAE. And in Saudi Arabia. And at their embassy in Kuwait. Of course, the Kuwaitis are keeping slaves in their homes. They're all from Southeast Asia, you know, maids, house servants, nannies, etc.
And you factor in, and I've at least got a nuanced enough understanding of Islam to know that there is a far cry of difference between Shia, Sunni, and that, and then Wahhabi is particularly virulent offshoot of Sunnah. And so I'm not kindly disposed toward them. You know, when you say they could be bankrupt in 2 years, Ron, that would indicate to me that there would be big troubles on the Arabian Peninsula.
Absolutely.
That maybe the swords might be falling on some necks that had been previously attached to bodies that were holding the swords. Because it won't be nice, will it?
No. Can I sense some small, tiny little flicker of hope that this might happen?
No, I'm not hoping because I'm scared to death that what comes next is even worse. You've tried to reassure me. But you know what happens if the ruling council says, "Yeah, okay, Mohammed bin Salman, we trusted you, and you got to go." Is there potential for civil war there?
No.
I mean, I'm fairly familiar with the rise of Ibn Saud, and the various and all of this, of course. Let's remember historically. All of this is a result of British meddling in that neck of the woods. or neck of the sand, as it were.
Yeah. It's the French.
Well, yeah. But in the case, the British tried to get comfy with both the Ibn Saud faction and the Husseini faction. Anybody who's ever seen Lawrence of Arabia knows that that is that film is predicated on the British relationship with the Hussein faction, who goes on to become King Hussein of Iraq, who gets deposed by the Ba'athists, who goes on to become King Hussein of Jordan, whose progeny is still on the throne there, and seems to be one of the more reasonable folks. Maybe to the extent that, you know, he acts a little, I guess we like him better because he acts a little Western, but God damn it, he doesn't sit on any oil.
Yeah, but, you know, small countries can maintain power, monarchies can maintain power as long as they appear reasonable. And, you know, Jordan is a perfect example of that. You're right. Iran, not so much. Saudi, not so much. UAE, I keep running into folks that, you know, they're just sitting on a shit ton of oil. Their first cousins are Qatar. They'd love to get along with Qatar because it's right across the bay, in effect. But the Saudis are pissed off with the Iranians. And therefore, the Saudis are pissed off with Qatar because Qatar is sort of friends with the Iranians because they've been dickering over some tiny little islands for the last 50 years out in the Gulf. And, you know, it's all very complicated. And a lot of people over there are just keeping their heads down, UAE being one, with the notable exception of all the bullshit that's going on in Yemen.
Well, I was about to raise that because aren't the Saudis and the UAE hand in glove in bombing the snot out of that poor place?
And the U.S.
Well, yeah, I mean that goes almost without saying, but let's go ahead and say it.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I saw a list earlier today, Ron, that noted that in the Arab world, there is only, and it was an index of freedom, okay, all over the world. But in the Arab world, there's only one country that is listed as being free. And that's Tunisia. Everybody else ranges from not so much to not at all. And down on the not at all scale is Saudi Arabia.
And I would put Kuwait down there as well. Every bit as bad. But those are the two personal, excuse the vernacular, but the two personal hard ones I've got for the Middle East would be Saudi and Kuwait. But Saudi and Iran are the two big powers over there. The Saudi military is just enormous. And every other country in the Middle East knows that if they really, really pissed the Saudis off and it came to a shooting war, they'd get wiped out, with the exception of Iran.
But would the Saudis actually march? Because there's not exactly a bunch of boots on the ground in Yemen, are there?
Oh, no, it's all air.
Right.
Air power. Yeah.
Have they been tested in terms of being willing to hear shots fired in anger?
Nope. I'll give you that. They haven't.
And as far as the Iranians concerned, they have the advantage of having actually engaged, well, granted a generation back, but engaged in real live, honest to God, live ammunition warfare with Iraq.
Yeah. Million or so casualties, I think.
So,
but you have to believe.
So
if Saudi got really upset with somebody, and it got to the point of armed conflict, you could expect that they would have a lot of eye in the sky resources available to them that their enemies would not.
through us?
Yeah.
So then would it not be better that we withdraw that shit?
How do you do that?
What do you mean? We don't let them have the information anymore. Change the password.
With the current regime?
That's ultimately the question I think we're leading up to here is, if we were to actually decide that we had the stomach to stand up on our own hind legs, how would we punish them?
Well, the only punishment that would really work is to cut off the market for the one export commodity they've got.
So just park the Navy in front of their loading terminals and say sorry? I mean, that's going to piss off the rest of the world, isn't it? We're not reliant that much on Saudi oil, but there's a hell of a lot of other countries that are.
Yeah, and Iran is sitting there. Iraq is sitting there. Kuwait is sitting there. UAE, Qatar, all of whom hypothetically would be allowed to put all their product through the Straits of Hormuz.
But again, we're engaged in fantasy because there's no way that a chicken shit like Donald Trump is ever going to do something like that.
No. And don't forget your friends in the North. You know, we're the biggest oil exporter to the U.S. right
now.
Well,
I mean, that's exactly why I said what I said. When we talk about we got to get off foreign oil, we're actually talking about Canadian oil and Mexican oil.
Yep.
So, the Saudis could not do to us what they did to us in 1973.
By the way, Bob, my bat channel on the other line has gone off.
From, oh, dear.
One of those foreign countries.
Okay.
I'm going to...
I think that means our little tete-a-tete has come to an end.
Yes. I'm sorry. I enjoyed it.
Well, I did too, and hopefully maybe we can extend it, because it's very complicated over there, and diplomacy is not easy.
Nope. A lot of layers in the onion.
And it's all onion all the way to the middle.
Yeah.
All right. Take care, Ron. So good to hear from you. My best to the Reverend Craig, the Reverend Williams, and Mr. Van Winkle.
That's all.
Exactly. Bye-bye. Later. The one and only Ron in the far, soon-to-be frozen north. And I wanted to ask those questions primarily because I'm trying to get past my own visceral responses. Like I said, I'm the don't go to war guy. But how many times do you let a piss ant shit on your shoes before you slap the fuck out of them? Remember me, I'm not a Christian, so I don't have to buy into that turn the other cheek business. And we've gone through several pairs of shoes that have been covered in Saudi shit. And so if I understand Ron correctly, imposing economic punishment is about the only way to make him see reason, or at least not run around murdering people who live in the United States. And we ain't going to do that. And the other side of that coin, and a question I was going to try to get to with Ron, but I didn't get a chance, is... And it's sort of an alternative timeline. What would have happened? Oh, God, here we go again. What would have happened if the person who won the election got to be president and the Iran agreement had been left in place? Because we understand now, looking back, that the real reason for the way that the Iran agreement was violated by the Trump regime was because the Saudis own his adipose orange ass. They yelled Froggy, and he... Well, how high, Your Highness? It's why his first foreign trip wasn't to any of our traditional allies, but to a gang of thugs in Riyadh. But if we had stayed in the Iran agreement and not engaged in all of this horse shit, are there people who realistically think that a country like Iran would just go bellowing and shrieking across its borders and invade the world? Because it's not my understanding that historically that's how they've operated. At most, they've done what, well, like the old Soviet Union did. They've funded mischief in various corners of the world, bloody mischief. But they haven't sent their massive army on the march. So what would have happened? And boy, what a case study in Washington's farewell address and avoid foreign entanglements. You know, George Washington wasn't saying don't engage in diplomacy. He wasn't preaching isolationism. It's another case of one of those late 18th century words that meant something to them that it doesn't necessarily mean to us. The words of Washington's farewell address were plain to the people who read it. And when they read avoid foreign entanglements, what they understood was don't get in bed business-wise with foreign countries. Keep them at arm's length. Have diplomatic relations, but focus on your own business. That's my understanding. And this is not... This has been largely ignored since roughly the Spanish-American War. We have sought out foreign entanglements. Yeah, isn't that interesting to look at the murder of a journalist and realize that it has its roots in a colonial lust for Cuba and the Philippines? Huh? Started out bad and went to worse. Oh, by the way, thank you very kindly to Pamela in Washington responding to Ralph's challenge and including a note. $1 for each year separate from my subscription. 15 years, 15 bucks. So that takes us down to 450 bucks answering Ralph's challenge. And then Brian jumped in and took us down to 425. Thank you, Brian. Thank you very kindly. And thank you, Pamela. We're making progress. We just need to get down to, we got 425 to do this evening, and then another 200 tomorrow evening. And if we can do that, we will have a program on Monday, and we'll have a 15th anniversary program, such as it is, on Wednesday. Going back to the issue of Elizabeth Warren and Native ancestry and whatnot, our buddy Reverbo pointed out about an hour ago slurs and racist displays used to have a higher risk of backfire. Not so much these days, since we let the white wing control the clock. Well, yeah, there was a time when monkey up, like Ron DeSantis used, within 12 hours of becoming the Republican nominee for governor in Florida, would have carried a substantial price. Now, the time period in which that price would have been exacted is not very broad. It would be, say, 1970 to 2008. But a price would have been exacted. Now, he gets applauded for it. Yeah. So it is indeed more than a little bit creepy and sickening. Oh, I wanted to throw something out there for our consideration. You saw the story, I'm sure, and it's, you know, freaking old news now. You saw the story of the dismissal of Stormy Daniels' defamation lawsuit against Julius Geezer. It was dismissed, and it was dismissed by a Bush appointee, Judge S. James Otero. And I just wanted to share his rationale with dismissing that case, because I think it is plainly wrong. In ruling that the case should be dismissed, he said, "If this court were to prevent Mr. Trump from engaging in this type of rhetorical hyperbole, you know, his defamatory slur against Stephanie Clifford, Stormy Daniels, it would significantly hamper the office of the president. Any strongly worded response by a president to another politician or public figure could constitute an action for defamation. This would deprive this country of the discourse common to the political process." This is, of course, pure bullshit. The court hasn't the power to prevent Mr. Trump from engaging in the linguistic filth that is his stock and trade. Even if a court were to enjoin his conduct, he would still do it, and he would say, "How you gonna stop me?" Because no court can remove Donald Trump from office. No court can charge him with anything, not even criminal contempt. Remember, Brett Kavanaugh thinks that he can't even be deposed. So Judge Otero is engaging in some right-wing sleight of hand when he says this crap. Stormy Daniels wasn't asking for him to be prevented. Stormy Daniels was asking that he be punished by the only thing that the law has to offer, namely money damages. Trump is free to say what he wishes. Now, on the other hand, if Otero had wanted to make some sort of a ruling under, say, Falwell v. Hustler, with the argument being that that Stormy Daniels was a public figure who sought out the... But she didn't. But the idea that holding the... And this is... I'm guessing this will not be appealed. because this is the kind of thing that Brat Kavanaugh is sitting around waiting for now. This rationale that it would significantly hamper the office of the president. Well, you know what? It doesn't hamper the office of the president if the president doesn't engage in defamatory slurs. How about that? And no, we're not talking about a strongly worded response by a president to another politician or public figure. Defamation has pretty clear boundaries in the law. That's not what Trump did. But I just wanted to point that out, that quote, as an example of the means by which right-wing appointed judges will do everything in their power. We've got an apolitical judiciary. Kiss my ass. This guy was covering Donald Trump's ass, and he knows it. So the president, thanks to Judge Otero in California, can say anything he wants about anybody he wants and get away with it. He can now call Stormy Daniels a whore. He could say that Stormy Daniels' mother was a whore. He can call someone the N-word and not worry about it. And I'm not talking about a political price. The maggots would eat it like chowder if he would start, if he would call every person of color that annoys him the N-word. But there's not even legal recourse for it now. Thanks to Judge Otero. So I just wanted to be clear about that. Thank you very kindly to Christopher, taking us down to 410. Thanks very kindly. Another dollar for each year you've been broadcasting, and that takes us down to 395. So we're on our way, and we've got a fighting chance. We just got to get there. About 48 minutes to do $395. Steve in New York, subject line Lebowski reference. Hey, Bob, this is actually not her seeking to impose a prior restraint, so there's nothing for the Supreme Court to roundly reject. No, it would be rejected on the ground, the Brat Kavanaugh grounds, that the president simply cannot be bothered with the law of the United States, because that is the stated position of Brat Kavanaugh. Let's run over to the let's run over to the stress line. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob, it's Darlene.
Hey, Darlene, how are you?
Good. I'm laughing at your Brat Kavanaugh.
Well, you know, 4th of July, right?
Yeah. I can't talk for long. I'm on deadline with two horrible state grants, one of which I just got uploaded, and I'm working on this other one, and it's been a nightmare from the get-go, so it's been consuming my time all week. But I've still been able to kind of keep my eye on what's going on in the news. And you're talking about, you know, how Trump, I don't know what this enabling thing is that's going on, but like what you were just talking about with the Stormy Daniels case. So I guess now Trump can commit, I guess, slander with reckless abandon and not be called out on it. And I don't know if you caught that story that CNN ran about the FBI building and the planned relocation of the FBI.
No, I think I missed that.
This has been a long time in coming, because the FBI The J. Edgar Hoover building is not only considered one of the ugliest buildings in Washington.
You know, I've walked past it many times, and it is ugly.
It's ugly. But the FBI has outgrown the space. it's no longer functional for them, and this has been a problem that's been ongoing for years. And as a matter of fact, because they've outgrown the space, certain functions are separated. Not everything is housed in one in the one facility. And the thought is that with this particular agency, everything should be housed under one roof. So I guess the plan that was in the making was that the FBI headquarters were going to be moved out of Washington and into the D.C. suburbs. And I guess that they were making plans, or they had plans to build a whole new facility. And Trump put a stop to it. And the Democrats, the House Democrats, are really pissed because the General Services Administrator, I guess her name is Emily Murphy, CNN's reporting that she misled Congress about the president's involvement in stopping the move of the FBI headquarters to a larger facility. And that, I guess that this is the Oversight Committee. And I think it's the Oversight Committee, and I think it's a combo thing also with appropriations. And I guess they questioned her in April, and she never, this Emily Murphy never let on that I guess that they had a meeting with Trump in January. And there's a photograph of the meeting, and I guess that's what got the Democrats in the House, really in this committee, pretty upset because Kelly's in the Oval Office in this meeting, this Emily Murphy, and then I think Christopher Wray is the current FBI director, and then Rod Rosenstein, and then there's some other guy there, and I don't know if it's Mnuchin or I don't recognize the guy on the end. But what it is, I guess, that she never let on in the hearing that they had this meeting. And this was they had the meeting in January, and then I guess she was up in front of the committee testifying in April, and that she never let on that Trump was directly involved in the decision to abandon this long-term relocation plan, and instead is proposing that a more expensive solution is to construct a new building on the same site where the J. Edgar Hoover building is.
Well, hold on. So what? The FBI goes and move. Oh, I know. They go and they move into that filthy hotel there, not very far away, in the old post office building.
Well, see, yes, you hit on the key, and you brought different angle to it. You've got a different angle to it. But I guess what they're saying is that before Trump became president, before he decided to run, he had expressed interest in buying the J. Edgar Hoover building to develop it when he caught wind that they were thinking of leaving that facility and moving into the burbs with the headquarters and expanding it. And so now that he's president, he can't outright buy it. So he doesn't want, I guess what the House Appropriations and Oversight Committee is saying is that he doesn't want anyone else, some competing developer, to come in and buy that vacant FBI headquarters if they were to move into the burbs, because it would potentially be competition to his little hotel there down around the corner.
Oh my God. And I wouldn't be surprised if he tried to mount some sort of bullshit legal argument, Darlene, that it's unfair to sell it to anybody because he can't bid on it because he's president. Unfair.
Oh yeah. Yep. Yep.
Good. You know, that makes me wonder. I wonder if the various rooms of that trashy hotel there in the old post office building, I wonder if they get feedback between the various Saudi bugs and the various Russian bugs that are probably in every room.
Yeah, I wondered that too. Yep. And he's trying to say that he wants to save, I guess this is, I think Sarah Sanders is saying the president wants to save the government money. And that she's claiming that the FBI leadership did not want to move its headquarters which is bullshit because, you know, years ago Robert Mueller testified they need more space. So that's just bullshit. So they're really upset with this Emily Murphy, this GSA director, whatever the heck she is. She's a general services administrator because they're basically saying that you lied. They're saying, you know, you lied to Congress in your testimony, and I guess they're trying to backtrack and say, oh, well, you know, she may have inadvertently, like she may have misled or that it gave the wrong impression. But I think they had pretty much asked her, you know, if he was involved in any decisions on this and or that whether or not they had met about it. And she would not divulge that information or, like, refuse to mention that they had had a meeting about it. So Maryland Representative Elijah Cummings is pretty upset about that.
You don't want him pissed off at you.
Elijah Cummings?
Yeah, no.
He'll
ruin your day. You've got the wheels turning in the community. David in South Carolina just sent me a note. Don't you see? Vlad wants the old FBI HQ property. Of course he does. It will be wonderful hotel for visiting Russian tourists. That's cousin Ivan Kincaid there. Yes.
Yeah, if Trump can keep it from being sold, you know, long enough until he's in a position to be able to buy it. I guess they met, it says here, new documents. This is, so Elijah Cummings, he's the top Democrat on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, and other senior Democrats. They wrote this letter to General Services, GSA, and Emily Murphy, suggesting that she misled Congress about the president's involvement. And they said new documents show that Trump met personally with you, the FBI, and White House officials on January 24th. And he was directly involved with the decision to abandon the long-term relocation plan and instead move ahead with a more expensive proposal. So it is a more expensive proposal to construct a new building on the same site, which it would have to be. Because I don't. Where else do you go? I assume the footprint would remain the same, so I guess you have to go higher. You got to probably redo a lot of stuff, and thereby.
Well, there are height restrictions in D.C.
So how then they must? I don't know. They must be planning to maybe knock down other facilities. I mean, it looks like it's tight quarters there.
It is.
Yeah. So you can
throw a rock and hit the Trump Hotel from there.
Right, because they said it's around the corner. They said that they're calling her out and calling him out and saying that this is an attempt to prevent Trump Hotel competitors from acquiring the land.
He doesn't believe in the free market anymore?
I guess not.
I mean, I thought the free market says, you know, get in there and compete, and may the best run business win.
Right, exactly.
And to the victor go the spoils.
Yep, exactly. They said the financial analysis conducted by, now this is the GSA's inspector general, so presumably an independent person of Emily Murphy.
Yeah, that's somebody who's going to be out of a job real soon.
Yeah, however, concluded that constructing a new FBI building in downtown D.C. would actually be more costly than relocating the Bureau. And they said, now GSO Emily Murphy's arguing that the emails Democrats cited were, whatever these emails were quote-unquote taken out of context. Yeah, the Trump Hotel. Yeah, they got a little map here. Holy shit, you're right. The Trump Hotel is, like, right there.
You can throw a rock.
You're right. They have FBI headquarters. The little old Trump Hotel is, like, literally a few blocks away. Or a block away.
Yeah, I took a picture of a friend of mine. He was standing on the sidewalk in front of the Hoover Building, and he held up his middle finger, and I took a picture of him with the big word Trump in the background. I don't just say things, Darlene.
That's hilarious. They have a little map here that shows the location. That's actually pretty good for CNN. It's actually a pretty good article. Let's see. They made the decision. Okay, so, and you know, I don't know. I'm trying to give Christopher Wray the benefit of the doubt because this guy's coming in under a real shitty circumstance. And I don't know if you saw, I didn't have a chance to watch the whole thing, but I caught the, I don't know which, it might have been the Judiciary Committee, questioned him not long after the whole Kavanaugh farce and debacle. And it was Kamala Harris. And she was kind of going easy on him. And he was sweating bullets over the whole Kavanaugh thing. And I mean, he just looked uncomfortable. He was sweating bullets. And I just think, like, he's trying to hold that line because, you know, he's dealing with this nutcase in the White House who's basically out to destroy the FBI. And I think he's trying to somehow walk that line where he can try to maintain some integrity for the agency.
You know, you and I have had a lot of conversations, not a lot, but some lately, and on email as well, about this. And it occurred to me, I was actually thinking about this the other day because, you know, it's what I do. I just sit around thinking about things. I mean, I don't want to take up too much of your time because I know you got to get back to work. But what's the end game here? If Donald Trump got his fondest wishes and could deliver the United States to the Russians and the Saudis on a silver platter, where does it go? How does it end? I mean, is the ultimate goal the end of constitutional governance? Is it the U.S. as a vassal state? Is it the U.S. as a neutered state? Because I started wandering down that road, and it just got real weird real fast.
Yeah, I mean, I that's a question I think more aptly put to Congress and the Republicans in Congress that are enabling this behavior, because I'm not so sure that Trump is thinking past his own financial and power gain in terms of what it means for this country. I don't think he gives a shit. I think it's about him and his own enrichment, his trying to grab power like a dictator. And I don't think he's thinking, well, this isn't good for the country. I don't think he cares. But that question is something that I think needs to be put to assholes like Lindsey Graham, you know, Chuck Grassley.
Yeah, how far are you willing to let it go?
Exactly. How far are you willing to ride this tiger?
And because the other thing that scares the life out of me, and I've been talking about this at some length, what happens when somebody who isn't as stupid as Trump comes along and takes over the Trump machine? Because the Republicans like the fervor and the fury that the maggots bring to the game. I mean, he's back out in Montana again this evening, I guess. But, you know, let's say one of those different kind of Republicans, say a Tom Cotton or a Ben Sasse, get hold of it. That actually scares me more than what we've got now, Darlene.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, I think there's some, we can take maybe some relief in the fact that Trump's stupid and doesn't really understand, doesn't care about history. But you're right. What if somebody is as root, you know, as narcissistic and sociopathic as Trump, but very intelligent and calculating and, you know, has the smarts to actually pull off a dictatorship. And you know it's going to get worse. Like, we didn't think it would get any worse than Bush, as in W. And now, by comparison, he's looking, I can't believe I'm saying this, but, you know, he's looking like a cakewalk compared to what we're dealing with
presidential
now.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. Well, again, I don't want to keep you, but I enjoy our conversations. I had not heard that story, and the idea of Donald Trump, because you know he's sitting there just giggling. Yeah, I'll put him all in pup tents. I'll put him in pup tents on Lafayette in Lafayette Park. That'll show him.
Yeah, and you know, I have to wonder about Rod Rosenstein, where he really stands on all of this, because he's got to be seeing it. He oversees the FBI.
Well, did it creep you out at all to see him sitting there shepherding the?
Oh, and McGahn, goodbye, fucker. So long. Glad you quit today. Because he's, you know, yeah, him and McGahn. And then I was grossed out seeing what's her name there. Kind of Condoleezza Rice, if you have a special name.
Oh, kind of sleazy rice goes great with kind of sleazy chicken.
Yeah. She was there on the first day backing him up.
McGahn, I expected to be there, and you know his resignation had been announced a couple of months ago, so he was going to stay until they got that, you know, credibly accused rapist onto the court. But Rod Rosenstein, yeah, that was a little weird because, what's the FBI doing monitoring, or what's the DOJ doing monitoring a Supreme Court hearing or a Supreme Court confirmation hearing? The DOJ is part of the executive branch. The Supreme Court is the judicial branch, and you know, sort of never the twain shall meet.
Right, and even so, the DOJ is still supposed to be somewhat independent of the office of the president as well. So I'm not sure why. I mean, you know. There, I thought he was kind of a straight up and up guy, but then there are some things he comes out with, like at that hearing where he roasted Jim Jordan. I think it was the same hearing where he pushed back against one of the senators about the Clinton independent counsel investigation, because I think he was working on that with Kenneth Starr. And he made a comment that there was definitely, indictable things that they were going after with Clinton. Like, he made it sound like it was not a sham. So, you know, I kind of wonder about him. You know, I don't know if he's like Christopher Wray is kind of there walking this real fine line, and they're trying to protect the special counsel, and they're trying to – you know, walk that fine line of keeping Trump happy, or at least satiated, you know, for another month or a few more days or whatever can keep them in their positions long enough for Robert Mueller to issue his report. But yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure why he was there, but it could just be because they're all, they all work together. I think
I'm halfway afraid that at the end of all of this, I don't want to feel this way. I don't want to think this, but that it may all come to naught. It seems like it can't possibly, and Mueller's gotten convictions. So after a while, just say, well, you know, we followed it as far as it would go, and you know, we ran out of gas. And it'll be like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and the Mueller report will be crated up in a wooden crate and shoved off into a warehouse somewhere, and the American people will never know what happened.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Mueller, I don't think he can help himself. If he finds anything illegal with Trump, he's going to want him. You know, he's going to want to see him in jail. That's who he is, but I would think something from the outside would have to prevent him from doing that. So,
go ahead.
If they were willing to hide the FBI report on the Kavanaugh non-investigation, then I think there's even more incentive to skiff it. And that's that, I don't know if you've heard of the SCIF, which is the secretive compartmented information facility, and
that's where the wooden crate goes with the Ark of the Covenant in it. Yes.
Yeah. It's that government building. It's the SCIF, and there might be more than one because Robert Mueller is said to work in the SCIF. So that everything he's doing is like totally top secret. But the Kavanaugh FBI, the FBI investigation into Kavanaugh, that 7-day non-investigation was skiffed as well. And that's why the senators had to go. I guess there's a room, a skiff in the down in the Capitol building, and they had to go into this room. No windows, and, you know, that kind of thing, and view the document.
So, well, I do wonder if there's any way that some of the skullduggery around the Saudi slaughter of Jamal Khashoggi, to the extent that there are finances involved. I wonder if there's any way that could wander into his brief, but they'd have to go to the. Well, no, I mean. He'd go to Rosenstein and ask, "Do you mind if I nose around?" That's what he'd do, wouldn't he?
In terms of the Saudi.
Yeah, Trump money, Saudis, dirty business, bribery, you know, whatever.
Oh, you mean Mueller?
Yeah.
I think he would. I think the only thing that would stop him would be Rosenstein, but Rosenstein seems to be giving him that rein, so. Because they worked together in the Boston U.S. Attorney's Office years ago, and Rosenstein looked up to him. Mueller was considered a legend at that point in time. So he might. I don't see, like he said, he'll take the investigation wherever it needs to go, wherever it leads him. I think if he finds any little indication that there's a connection, I think he'll try to go for it. You know, I mean, although he's considered apolitical, if there is such a thing, this has got to be killing him to see what Trump is doing to the FBI that he devoted 12 years of his life to, and how he's eviscerating it.
Well, you would think. Darlene, thanks for calling in. I always enjoy our conversations.
Yeah,
and good luck with the deadline.
Thanks. Yeah, I got to get it done and then make some soup and get back up at it tomorrow morning first thing.
Yeah, the beginnings of the pot of chili are on the stove.
Aren't they? Yeah. And at some point I want to ask you about, maybe I'll ask you real quick. What did you think about, I sent you an email on it, and I don't know if you had seen it, but the whole thing with Chief Justice John Roberts referring those ethics complaints about Kavanaugh to outside judges outside of Washington, D.C. that he had been sitting on during the hearing. Any thoughts on what's going on there?
It's a non-entity. Nothing's going to come of it.
I wonder what made him. Yeah.
Well, he had to.
I wonder what made him do it.
He had to.
Yeah, because he had some scrutiny on him for not doing anything.
Well, he had to do it because they have to do that because they concern a circuit court judge over which the Supreme Court has oversight, and so consequently, he farms it out to the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. The 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Let me see here. I'm just trying to find the. Yeah, there's the wiki on it.
But isn't it suspicious that he sat on it and did nothing with it until?
Well, yeah, but if you really want to know that the fix is in, consider what states make up the 10th Circuit.
Okay.
Colorado, Kansas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Utah, and Wyoming.
Oklahoma three times?
Yeah, there's an eastern and northern and a western district of Oklahoma.
Okay. So all the western kind of Republican.
Yeah, it's as Republican as you can get because nobody got on those courts without the consent of a Republican senator.
Right.
All right. So when you so naturally he has to send it out.
Right.
But he's
basically sending it out to friendly.
Yeah, he's sending it out to a court that'll take a look at it and go, oh, it's just a bunch of pissed off liberals, snowflakes, crybabies, get over it, and that'll be the end of it. I mean, I wish I had, if I had a different opinion, I would certainly say it, but I don't see that.
No, happening. I agree. I agree. I think I'm suspicious of this referral.
I am as well.
Yeah.
And it's gonna, in the words of Mayella Yule, it won't come to nothing.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Bob. Well.
All right, Darlene. You have a good evening.
Yes, you too. And a shout out to Scary Jerry.
Oh,
Florida.
Oh, hey, yeah, absolutely.
Scary Jerry.
Absolutely.
He always says hello to me, so to say hello to him.
All right.
All right, Bob. You take care.
See you, Darlene. Bye now.
All right. Bye bye.
Darlene calling from Connecticut. Let's see here. Let's keep track because things are getting better. Thank you to Louie for helping us take things down a little bit. Let's see, is that 350 now? We're down to $350 to go. Thank you, Louie, and thank you very kindly to everyone who's jumped in thus far this evening. Make sure I didn't miss anybody. Thank you, Glenn. 340. Closer and closer. 340 to go. And by the way, Steve in New York has put a $25 challenge on the table. If that gets met, we will knock it down underneath the $300 mark. And that's huge. So 340 to go. $25 challenge on the table. And 18 minutes before the hour. I'm going to go to the phones here in a second, but I want to share something with you. After we were done with my conversation with Ron, he sent along something entirely different. This is a no-kidding, real-live, not-a-joke radio ad. It comes from Arkansas. It's a radio ad for a Republican member of Congress named French Hill. The ad is running, I don't know if it's only, but primarily on radio stations that operate within the market for African Americans there in that district in Arkansas. You might want to get the hockey puck. Okay, ready? Go.
What do you think about what's happening in Washington?
Our Congressman French Hill and the Republicans know that it's dangerous to change the presumption of innocence to a presumption of guilt, especially for black men. If the Democrats can do that to a white justice of the Supreme Court with no evidence, no corroboration, and all of her witnesses, including her best friend, say it didn't happen, what will happen to our husbands, our fathers, or our sons when a white girl lies on them?
Girl, white Democrats will be lynching black folk again.
Honey, I've always told my son, don't be messing around with that. If you get caught, she will cry rape.
I'm voting to keep Congressman French Hill and the Republicans because we have to protect our men and boys. We can't afford to let white Democrats take us back to bad old days of race verdicts, life sentences, and lynchings when a white girl screams rape.
Paid for by Black Americans for the President's Agenda. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
Black Americans for the President's Agenda. Both of them. Oh, Jesus. God, I kind of hope Tracy's not listening right now. The level of disinformation and misinformation here is halfway to NORBLAP 9. I'll just reiterate that the presumption of innocence was not at stake. Guilty until proven innocent remains the criminal standard in this country. However, If you are a nominee for a Supreme Court seat, the burden is upon you to prove your fitness for the position for which you've been nominated. Please, somebody, tell me this ain't going to work. And by the way, Representative French Hill didn't have diddly to do with the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh as a member of the House of Representatives. This thing relies on people having no idea how their government works. It's kind of like a constitutional amendment that we have on the ballot here in West Virginia that reads, nothing in the Constitution of the state of West Virginia supports a constitutional right to have it. I'm not quoting, but the front end is very nearly a quote. Nothing in the Constitution of the state of West Virginia says blah, blah, blah. In other words, the people of the state of West Virginia, 99.9% of whom have never even read the first five words of the Constitution of the state of West Virginia, are being called upon to interpret what is or is not in the Constitution of the state of West Virginia. It is, of course, an anti-abortion constitutional measure. Because, see, here in West Virginia, we have a Supreme Court decision that says that the state of West Virginia cannot refuse Medicaid payments for Medicaid patients who seek to have an abortion. Which makes sense because equal protection would say that you cannot craft a law that says we're only going to shit on poor people. We're only going to shit on poor people who are women. But Emory and Marvelline, who not only haven't read the Constitution of the state of West Virginia, but can't spell it and couldn't find it with both hands, are going to be called upon to interpret it as though they were some sort of Solon. Yeah. Steve in New York says, sad news, Tracy's head just exploded. Hopefully Tracy is not listening. Steve from Georgistan says, Bob, are you sure that wasn't an ad from The Onion? No, that really is an ad that's running on African-American radio stations in Arkansas, which the stations are running because money. Ah, okay. Okay. Thank you for letting me know that, Darius. Darius in Oregon is also Speed in Arizona. Thank you. Good to know. Thank you, Ron. Ron in the far frozen north, soon to be frozen north, says, proud to serve in the army of Bob, Bob, Bob. Maybe that won't constitute gimmick infringement, Ron. I'll see if you can get a dispensation from Ron in Raleigh, okay? So let's run over and check in with Scott. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Bob. Let me do what I can to while away the final moments of the program.
You've got 11 of them.
With goodies. It's not enough to hope that Tracy is not listening to the previous political commercial. We must hope that she's not driving as she's listening.
Well, this is where you get into the conundrum. Do I write to her and say, for God's sakes, Tracy, if you happen to pick up the podcast, it's okay to listen to everything up to the 8 minutes and up to the 2 hours and 35 minute mark, but then you have to turn it off or it'll be Mars Attacks all over again with the yodeling.
Well, there you go. And the reason we don't want Tracy to be listening and driving is because I don't care who you are. There's nobody in the state of California who can negotiate these highways without a head. You know, it's just an impossibility. Although I've seen them try, metaphorically speaking, these people out, these bastards drive like literally there's no tomorrow. Or as old Bob Harrington, the chaplain of Bourbon Street, told me when I was speeding to take him to a radio appearance many moons ago, you drive like you're saved. So make of that what you will. I've got a couple of TV viewing tips and then some memories about the J. Edgar Hoover building, if you will permit me.
Go, man.
TV viewing tip number one. If you did not see American Experience on PBS this week, just Google American Experience and the word eugenics. It was a two-hour
program. Oh, that sounds like a little light viewing.
Oh, but Bob, it's relevant. In today's world, are you kidding me? Especially today's American world. In the early minutes of the show, we learn about the pioneering work in the field by one Henry Herbert Goddard, a prominent American psychologist and eugenicist in the early 20th century. On May 18th, 1910, before a conference of his peers, there was a room full of these people, he coined the term moron, to wit, any person with mental age between 8 and 12. Morons, according to Goddard, were unfit for society and should be removed from society either through institutionalization, sterilization, or both.
That's a rotten thing to say about Trump supporters.
Well, as you might imagine, upon learning this nugget of stuff, my mind immediately ran to recent news that more than a few people in the inner circle at the White House have used that very term, moron, to describe Trump. So given that, it's certainly no wonder that Trump is not exactly a fan of science or PBS for that matter. And my contribution to PBS went out yesterday for their fine choices in programming. Are you kidding me? Jeez. My mind immediately went to Trump. If that doesn't describe Trump, then I don't know what does. Never mind fucking moron, which I think one of the cabinet members or one of the...
Well, that only happens when his pants are off.
Jeez. I just don't know. So American Experience, just Google it and the word eugenics. And I guarantee you that 2 hours is quite informative and worth your time. And another TV viewing tip, and this is on the topic, you raised the question of the 73 Arab OPEC oil embargo, which I remember that as being toward the end of my first year in radio, driving from Alexandria down to Prince Frederick, Maryland in my little red Vega, making all of $2.15 an hour to play records and be silly. Well, you know, gas went from, oh, I don't know, 48 cents a gallon up to 75 cents a gallon in just a matter of days, it seemed like. And I forget now what the OPEC's reasoning was for the embargo. I think it was favorable stuff toward Israel, if I'm not mistaken. You got to remember, Nixon was president back then. Let's see, the 73 Mideast War, had that just happened or was that just ahead? Remember that quick war that lasted like less than a week? I don't know. I get my...
Yeah, I do, and
confused.
I'm not sure. I'm looking it up right now just to...
Yeah.
1973 oil crisis.
Yeah. But I'm trying to recall whether...
The embargo was targeted at nations perceived as supporting Israel during the Yom Kippur War.
Yeah, there you go. That's
the initial nations targeted were Canada, Japan, the Netherlands, the United Kingdom, and the United States.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, it threw a crimp at everybody's driving, and it was quite an incredible thing to go through when you were used to like 46, 47 cents a gallon gas, which I'm sure the younger people out there are saying, who is this old bastard raving on like this about, you know, gas for less than two quarters a gallon? Well, it's me, boys and girls. That's my memory. But, man, it shot up immediately. And then they had the even and odd rationing days where if your license plate ended in an even number, you could get like $5 worth of gas, and that was it. And then the next day, if your license plate ended in an odd number, you could get 5 gallons of gas. So, I mean, those were days we don't want to see come back. And the reason I raise it as a TV viewing tip, in 1992, there was a PBS series, miniseries called The Prize, an epic quest for oil, money, and power based on the book, a big old fucking bookstop or doorstop of a book by, I can't think of his name, but it was a pretty good series, and it's on Amazon Prime, and it's worth the time. You know, it's 6 or 8 episodes, and they're quite good. And it gives you the history of OPEC, which I think came into being around 58, somewhere in there, the late 50s, as I recall. My question, if we put sanctions or punishment on Saudi Arabia, who's one of the members of OPEC, is the OPEC of today as cohesive and unified as the OPEC of 73 and later in the 70s when they were breaking ugly? Have you given this any thought at all? I mean,
not to the degree that you obviously have. And
Well, somebody must think of these things, you know.
Absolutely.
And because we don't need wrenches thrown into, you know, the stability of our economy or the world's economy. I mean, Trump is doing enough with his craziness. So maybe somebody knows, and we can explore that, you know, on the front porch tomorrow. Because that's the thing about these pivotal moments. They happen, and then sometimes they don't happen again for 40 or 50 years, and you have a population when they reoccur or recur, whichever it is, who has no memory or knowledge even of what happened before. And you know, in today's world, the people, a lot of them are just pig ignorant. I don't mean to disparage pigs, but, you know, and that thing about history, if you don't learn from it, you're bound to repeat it.
Well, Ron in the far soon to be frozen north would like you to know a couple of things.
Sure.
He says, please advise Scott that there are so many alternative sources of supply now that it wouldn't happen again. Also, there are many members of OPEC who would abandon the Saudis in a New York minute.
Well, yeah, that's true too.
And we did learn one lesson from it, and that was the creation of the Strategic Oil Reserve.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that's why every time gas prices go up, and some Republican says, "Well, we need to open up a Strategic Oil Reserve."
Yeah,
because I got to get reelected. I don't know what it. I don't know what it is out there, and I know you don't drive, and so hence may not pay a lot of attention to it. But
I think regular is 3-something a gallon. Well, like 3.51.
Yeah, gas regular here just hit $3 a gallon.
Yeah.
And in about 15 seconds, I'm going to get an email from Robert in Australia saying, oh, please.
Yeah, I know.
but in the economic context of people struggling paycheck to paycheck, you know, It was not that long ago that it was 250. And yeah. I can even remember a couple of years back when the Saudis decided to try to put the North Dakota oil sands out of business and succeeded for a while, and it dropped to we got down close to $1 a gallon for a little while.
Oh yeah, it was like $30 or thereabouts a barrel.
And you can't help wondering if that's another, you know, that's another byproduct of the fact that they own Trump.
So that's where my mind went, you know, when the topic went to oil and OPEC and embargoes and punishments and things like that, because, you know, having been through it once before, I'm not really interested in seeing us go through it again, because, I mean, that really screwed the 70s in terms of the economy, and that wasn't the whole thing. I mean, we had to pay the piper for our folly and misadventures in Vietnam.
All of that folds in together, but
Economic crisis of the 70s, that got us a paralyzed, ineffective Jimmy Carter for 4 years, which in turn got us 8 years of
Reagan. it damn near got Gerald Ford bumped off of the Republican ticket for president in 76. Speaking of which, since we're kind of in the at play in the fields of history moment, run over to the Atlantic. It's too much to go into right now, but it's from the November 2018 issue, theatlantic.com. James Fallows is the author, and this is the kind of thing that'll just right in your wheelhouse, Scott.
Okay.
Read, was Gary Hart set up?
Oh, I saw the link, but I didn't read it.
Read it. Good? Yeah, read
yeah,
it.
Fallows is good. I remember him when he was in the waning days of the Washington Evening Star, the afternoon paper that went away around 81 or so.
Well, this is, I don't want to give it away, but the answer is yes.
Yeah, well, I think.
And the usual, and given the time frame, the usual suspects are involved. But it gives you another one of those places, and I don't remember ever pondering it, but if Gary Hart becomes president, then no George H.W. Bush, obviously, no Bill Clinton, no W, and once again, no Trump.
Yeah. There are so many times in our history when we could have made a better choice had we been able to, but whoever did this, and I look forward to reading the article in terms of bringing Gary Hart down, they prevented us from even having that choice. That's how scared they were of losing influence and power. These are some pretty diabolical, and I don't think that's too strong a word, some pretty diabolical forces. I'm telling you. And I don't need to tell you that. Hell, you could probably school me on it.
Well, it's well worth the read. Hey, Scott, we got to get out of here. We've run 3 minutes over, my friend.
Okay, let me close with a quick happy note.
Okay.
Chirps the Cat, who I'm sure you recall.
Yes.
Had a hat trick in terms of kitty cat entertainment just earlier this afternoon.
Do tell.
I hear this scurrying outside, and I figure, well, it's the squirrel climbing up the rough side of the front yard palm trees, which it was, but the squirrel was being chased up the said palm tree by a gray dog, like a mastiff or a pit bull or something, wearing a leather collar and a kerchief, you know, those like railroad engineers' kerchiefs,
yeah,
around his little neck, trying to climb the fucking tree. mind you. So Chirps had that those two for entertainment. The scared shitless squirrel scurrying up the tree, the gray dog wearing the kerchief, and then a little later when that calmed down, Spunky, the sparrow, came to visit, sitting on the banister. And this is like cable TV for cats, especially Chirps. Just the delight in viewing pleasure. So I was happy for her and me, because it gave me a chance to tell the dog to not pee or shit on the lawn, what there is of it, and to go pursue, to find the route home, because I was not interested in any, chewed up squirrels or birds on the property. It would harsh my chill or whatever that
your mellow
terminology
yes,
is.
It would harsh
my
your mellow. Mellow
yes. Well, have a good mellow yourself there, Bob.
Well, I'm going to try, and Scott, we'll talk again soon, okay?
Yes, we will.
Yes, we shall.
We shall. Take care, Bob.
All right, later. Bye now. Our buddy Scott in San Diego. Time to get on out of here. Okay, let's just recap where we stand right now. We've got to finish the week's fundraising, or hey, there ain't no horn come Monday. And it has to do with bills that have to be paid. We are at $340 to go. We have a $25 challenge on the table, courtesy of Steve from New York. Tomorrow there will be another $200. That makes it we finish the evening basically looking at $540 tomorrow evening. But tomorrow evening's Friday on the front porch. I'm looking forward to it. I hope you are as well. And maybe I'll have a report on the initial first tastings of the chili. Wouldn't that be fun? Thanks, everybody, for keeping the program on the air. Hey, thanks for the note, Scary Jerry. Scary Jerry with a shout-out going back to Darlene. Oh, my God, she said my name, Scary Jerry. As I sit here and chuckle about snow and winter, furtively refreshing the FloridaHurricane.com site. Scary Jerry notes, I called the Michael disturbance a Cat 5 way before the national media even noticed or cared. Still 85 here. At least the sky isn't rolling or clouds circling like a pinwheel. I keep talking about 11 years and 355 days today. Scary Jerry says, I don't think we even have 5 years to fix this. Climate chaos is real, and I'm on the front lines. Real thoughts and prayers, says Scary Jerry, for the survivors of Michael and that awful tsunami in Indonesia. Pro tip, don't watch any tsunami video. NSFL. Thank you, Scary Jerry. Thank you so very much. And I will tell Boss Man Wayne to put on the spider-proof gloves. So that's it. Back tomorrow, Friday on the front porch. And thanks to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program. Thank you to Sparky this evening in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.